Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 13th, 2005. Today's session is Beyond Words, Sojourners in the Wilderness. Part 1, Calls, Calling, Going Barefoot. Presented by Fred Niedner. In the Fireside Room. Disc number 2005-01.
I think that it's probably self-explanatory. The man in the booth over there is Antonio, and he will record this. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Fred Niedner. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, serving this week as Bible study leader. Couple of preliminaries before we get into the subject and the meaning of the subject and then the actual content. I have to begin with a totally side remark this morning, because last evening in the sermon I had a little note in there about the occasions on which we find ourselves in need of an excuse because we're about to be late and we need to begin forming the reason that we can justify ourselves. Well, I didn't plan on needing such a thing myself quite so soon, but this morning happened to be my turn as Bible study leader to do the 7:30 class, and lo and behold, I woke up this morning thinking, it feels later than it ought to be. I grabbed my alarm clock and noticed that it was 7:25. So I simply threw on clothes and dashed down here and got started only a moment or so late. And I had no excuse. It was my own fault, my own most grievous fault. I went back at 8:30 to check and try to understand this, and lo and behold, when I changed my alarm clock to Pacific time, I set it to PM. The alarm function, that is. So that is still my fault. No one did it for me or to me. I messed up my own alarm clock. But in any case, it reminded me of a narrative in my early adult life that vaguely fits in with the theme this morning. I did something very similar the very first time I was ever to preach for a real congregation, and not just a class of my seminary contemporaries in a homiletics class. The very first Sunday I preached at my internship congregation in Memphis, Tennessee, I stayed up half the night memorizing my sermon. I even went down to the church and stood in the pulpit and preached it, you know, practice run at 1 o'clock in the morning. And noticed that in the pulpit, I had never got up in that pulpit before. I noticed that up in the pulpit, somebody had taped the Bible text, "Sir, we would see Jesus." The line that Philip rings at one point when some Greeks want to see Jesus. And I knew what that meant, that you were supposed to, you know, make Christ come alive to people from this pulpit. So anyway, I finally finished my preparation, went to bed, could hardly sleep because I was so full of adrenaline, and the next thing I knew, the phone was ringing. And the pastor's voice said, "Fred, are you coming?" And I said, "Why? What time is it?" And he said, "It's 8:05. And the service started at 8, and I lived 5 minutes away. And I was fresh out of bed. So I threw on clothes, tore down to the church, and it was the kind of place that you could appear sort of deus ex machina in the pulpit during the sermon hymn, so that I didn't have to go through the spectacle of coming up the aisle or something like that. So I simply appeared there in the pulpit at the appropriate time. But I'm sure I didn't fool anyone. And the great irony of this somehow is that the text was the story in Luke of the raising of the widow's son at Nain. And I'm sure that the people didn't see Jesus in the pulpit that morning, and they saw that dead guy that had just been raised from the tomb and was trying to figure out, what do you say now? So I almost had that same experience this morning here at 7:30. But now I'm practiced, and I think I know what to say. Before I ever came to Holden, back in the days when people were still telling me, you've got to go to Holden Village, as happens to most of us, I once talked with Elmer Witt about what it was like to be up here and to do sessions up here. Some of you will remember that Elmer was the director up here almost a generation ago. And he told me all kinds of interesting things, but one of the things that stuck in my mind was that you don't ever forget at Holden that a part of everything has to be hilarity. And so I got in the habit of not trusting that hilarity might actually happen spontaneously during the session, and so I attempt to force it right at the beginning and get that over with. And also then, if it works, you know, then you've actually got something to take away from the session, even if the rest of it doesn't work. So just for fun, I brought along a couple things. It's hard to find humor about taking off your shoes. It's a short genre. But I found at least one thing that sort of works, but it's in a collection, so you have to listen to part of the whole collection. These are just little sayings that I think they were presented to me first as things that are Zen-like. Anyway, it's always darkest before dawn, so if you're going to steal your neighbor's newspaper, that's the time to do it. Always remember that you're unique, just like everyone else. If at first you don't succeed, skydiving is not for you. Here's one that's slightly sexist. Actually, it's very sexist, but I don't think anyone will care. Give a man a fish and he can eat two meals in a day. Teach him how to fish and he will sit in a boat and drink beer all day. If you lend someone $20 and never see that person again, it was probably worth it. There's a fine line between a hobby and a mental illness. Here's one that sort of fits with Holden. No matter what happens, somebody will find a way to take it too seriously. But here's the one then that goes with the theme. Here's my theme line for the day. Before you criticize someone, you should walk a mile in their shoes. That way, when you criticize them, you're a mile away and you have their shoes. It's a very wise saying. Worthy of all pondering. Well, I've titled this week's sessions Beyond Words, Wilderness Sojourns and Sojourners. And I want to say a word first about that title before we get into a biblical story. And what we're going to start with is the very story that the take off your shoes or take off your sandals line comes from, the story of God's call to Moses at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. This story takes place in the wilderness, and it takes place in a very special piece of wilderness, as we'll see shortly. But I want to talk for a moment about wilderness in general and why I've titled it title this session as I have. We're in the wilderness, so it's appropriate for us to talk about wilderness existence and wilderness sojourns. And by some chance or another, 80% of the Torah, the Pentateuch, books of Moses, this piece of primal literature for both Jews and Christians, takes place in the wilderness. We sometimes don't pay attention to that, but Exodus has a little bit of action in Egypt. The rest of it is in the wilderness. And the same is true for all of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Now, it's not all narrative. There's a lot of law in there, but it's all in the wilderness. The significance of that sometimes escapes us. What does it mean to be in the wilderness? Well, I've developed a thesis of sorts in recent years that you won't find elsewhere from more cautious and responsible people. But I've studied this word, the wilderness, in the Bible and come up with my own understanding of it. And now I'm trying to convince others that it's worth entertaining. If you want to find any word in the Hebrew language in a lexicon, you have to, at least in by tradition and the way Hebrew lexicons are arranged, you have to figure out what is the three consonant root of that word. The way Hebrew has been understood classically, it's built around each word comes from some three-letter root. Now, this has been called into question in recent times, but you still have to look words up in the lexicon that way. The word for wilderness in Hebrew is midbar. That's how it sounds, midbar. And to find it in a Hebrew lexicon, you have to look up the word davar, the last three consonants. And the word davar in Hebrew is the word for word. It's the word also, the verb form is the verb, one of the verbs for speech, speaking. It also happens to be the word for a deed or a thing. And it's one of the marvelous curiosities of the Hebrew language that the word for word and the word for deed are the same thing. And it's really great when people's words and deeds match, but it's usually only true of God. Anyway, that's what you have to look up in Hebrew to find the word for wilderness, davar, the word for word. Now, you can do a lot of things to Hebrew roots. You can just as we do in English, you can put suffixes and prefixes and so forth on them. And one of the prefixes you can put on a word is one that means from, just like we do in Latin or in English or in lots of other languages. And so the word midbar appears, at least to me, to be a combination of the preposition min, which means from, and davar, which means word or speaking. And you always elide the letter N, the nun in Hebrew, if it's connected. And so you don't say min davar, you say midbar. Now, there's one little difficulty with this. There's no extant sign of the disappearance of that N, which there really ought to be. But I checked this out with my own Hebrew teachers, including Ralph Klein at Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, and he said, "Well, Fred, I can't prove you're wrong, but I can't prove you're right. So I'm going with it." Now, what do you get when you have a word that's from separation, distinction, connected to the word for word? In Hebrew, the way to make a comparative is to add a min to the beginning of something. If you want to say something is greater than something else, the thing that gets the van gets a min on it. And so you distinguish something from something else by putting a min on it. I've decided, given the way the place, and I use the word place somewhat loosely in that sentence, functions in the Bible, Midbar means beyond words, apart from words. Because the way the wilderness functions in the Bible, it is the place where our words don't work anymore. It's the place where our language has come to an end. And if this is a true derivation, I can imagine that it comes from a place, it's the no place place. By the way, the Greek word for wilderness means the same thing. Eremos is a word that means wordless. So maybe this is related. It's or that's one of the words anyway. So what we find in the Hebrew Bible is that the wilderness, the primary version of which is the place between Egypt and the Promised Land, is the place of transition in the Bible. We used to be slaves, but now we're not anymore, but we aren't exactly free either. We're in the place where all of our old words don't work, but we don't really have new ones yet either. We're in the in-between place. We're in the place beyond words. And so I take Midbar to be a kind of prototypical word for all the times in life, biblically understood the same way, that we are in the in-between times, in the wilderness transition moments of our lives. Just because the Israelites got away from the Pharaoh and the slave drivers didn't mean they were thinking yet like free people, as we'll see later in the week, and as you may remember, they weren't very far distant from Egypt when they began to not just desire, but to dream about and long for and whine over the fact that they no longer had all the things that they remembered so fondly from Egypt, the leeks and the melons and the onions and the cucumbers and the garlic, forgetting completely that they had that at the price of slavery. They were free, but they couldn't yet live and think like free people. So they were somewhere in between. They were in transition, and the wilderness times of our lives are the times when our old ways don't work anymore, and we don't yet really have new ones to replace them. So we're in transition. So that's where my title comes from: Beyond Words. Moses is out in the place beyond words when this story happens, and as we'll see, the primary story for Israel in the Pentateuch, once you get beyond Genesis, is the way they come to live in the place beyond words, and what they receive out there in the wilderness, of course, is a whole lot of words. Words for a new life, words for a different way of being, words that become the Torah, that become the commandments, that become the covenant, that become the way to live so that you don't ever become slaves again. So, with that little background, I thought we would start just by looking at the story from which we get our theme this week. We'll just have our crack for the week at looking at Exodus 3, verses 1 to 12. Could we do the somewhat old-fashioned thing of going around and getting it allowed into the space of the room by having a person at a time read a verse or two. Can we start here and just it? Start it. Exodus 3, verse 1, and read through verse 12, and just read a verse or two and stop, and somebody else will take up.
Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up.
When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground.
Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face, because he was afraid to look at God.
Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites.
The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppressed them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? He said, I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain.
Okay. Now the story really goes on for a while with a lot of conversation and negotiation between God and Moses, which is the pattern of those two. You know, by the way, God and Moses always in each other's faces about one thing and another. We could spend a week just on this story. There are so many fascinating things in just those 12 verses. But before I set any particular kind of agenda, is there anything there that anybody wants to ask about? Something that's surprised you this time through, or some mystery you've always wanted to ask, and the rest of these people can answer for you? All right. Well,
Fred, yeah, yeah. I just noticed it was because of your allusion to the wilderness and beyond and so forth, that in the NRSV, at least, the first verse, Moses led his flock beyond the wilderness.
Right.
That never had struck me before. What is beyond the wilderness? I mean, yeah. You go, wilderness is beyond, you know, there's a known area and then there's wilderness. But
yeah.
What's beyond the wilderness?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. There's something very curious. Now, I forgot. What does the NIV say?
It's to the far side of the desert.
On the far side.
Yeah, man.
Of the desert. And it's actually in Hebrew at this point, the word achar, which means behind or in the back. And nobody knows exactly how to translate that. Over the centuries, people have struggled with this. Achar, the achar of something is the backside of something. Later on in the week, if we get to it, we're going to look at a story where we see even God has a backside. And this is the word there, too. Robert Alter's new translation of the Pentateuch and commentary and notes with it suggests that we translate this into the deep part of the wilderness, as opposed to somehow or another getting away from the wilderness, as though, you're exactly right. If you're in the wilderness, and if you're not leaving the wilderness, then the mountain is in the middle of the wilderness. You haven't gotten away from the wilderness, but somehow or another, you've gotten... It's so wilderness, it's beyond wilderness.
I think it's just an early author's idea of a map. It's a map in his head, because it is a specific place. It's got a latitude and a longitude. That's where the mountain is.
Yeah.
So for that guy, you know, he didn't know quite what the cartographers were calling it, so he came up with his, you know, it's out there at the beyond place.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah. It's not nebulous. It does have a Latin long, doesn't it?
Well, and it is a specific place.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's this mountain. And of course, in the tradition, this mountain, it's a known place. It's not an unknown place. Mm-hmm. But it is in a very real way the deepest place in the wilderness. It's the place, whereas we'll find over and over again in the rest of the story of Exodus anyway, and the whole story of the giving of the law, Moses is going to end up seeing things that people shouldn't see. So you've got yourself into a place that's beyond just wilderness somehow. So yeah, that's one of the curiosities.
I would interject also, there's probably a very practical reason for him going there. If he's tending these flocks, the more familiar areas might not have good pasture for those flocks, and in order to find a place, you have to go beyond the desert, which is always inhospitable.
Yeah. Well, the word wilderness doesn't exactly connote desert. That's why I'm not so smitten with the NIV translation at this point. There's a different word for desert. Desert in the sense of, we're not in a desert up here, but this is wilderness. Wilderness has to do both in the Bible and in the way we use it. It's not so much the place where there's that's uninhabitable, it's that it's wild. I mean, that's what our English word means, the place of wild things.
It's probably not a good place for keeping sheep up here.
Well, no, not with deer.
That's one of the, I think, the central themes about the contrast between the what we call civilization and the wilderness. And unfortunately, the people who came across from Europe to America, at least on the East Coast, had a very negative connotation about wilderness, instead of seeing it as a place for inspiration and revelation. And Gary Snyder, in his book, The Practice of the Wild, talks a lot about how in other cultures they see, like in the Taoism, they see intelligence as being embodied by the wilderness, and whereas in the West there tends to be more that civilized area is where we have knowledge and the wilderness is something to be avoided. This from Exodus, it shows that actually revelation happens to be out there in the wilderness.
Yeah. Especially in the Midwest, we like our life laid out in grids. You people out here in the West with these towns where the roads go all over the place, this does not work for us.
Modern environmentalists also talk about wilderness being a distinction of privilege, because it implies fences and land ownership on the other side of wilderness, and a little bit different than Old Testament.
Well, as I said, there are a lot of places we could plunk down here and spend an enormous amount of time. I mean, this thing is just full. Any other mysteries somebody wants to raise? You'd have at least one if you were not plopping down at Exodus 3:1, but had been reading the story straight through. Moses, and if we have time this week, we'll look at this story too. Moses just got married in the previous chapter, but he didn't marry the daughter of anybody named Jethro. He married the daughter Zipporah, the daughter, one of the seven daughters of Reuel. So one of the curiosities of these stories is that you have one group of stories where Jethro is the father-in-law of Moses, and another whole group where Reuel is the father-in-law of Moses. And this, of course, is one of the things, along with the name of God and the name of the mountain, by the way. Horeb has another name, as you all know, or maybe you don't know that you know. Horeb is also Mount Sinai. There are two different sets of stories. And sometimes the mountain is Horeb and sometimes it's Sinai. And this is part of the evidence that has given rise to the theory of the composite nature of the Pentateuch, pieced together from strands of tradition, rather than written all at once by Moses, the way the tradition has it. That tradition isn't as old as we think, by the way. The tradition that Moses wrote it all appears rather late. I mean, it seems to be implied in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah when the covenant is read before the people after the exile. But a real theory of how this happened didn't develop until the Hebrew language got outlawed in the 3rd century by the Hellenistic Empire, and some people thought, well, we should just translate the Bible into Greek so that our children can learn the stories in a legal language. And this horrified some people because they thought it perverse and abhorrent that you could put the very words of God into the language of these heathen pig eaters who are persecuting us, the Greeks. God does not speak Greek. And so to try to say that it was utterly wrong to translate the Bible into Greek, they began to teach that not even Moses had written this, but God himself, or God had written personally the entire Pentateuch and simply given it to Moses, and what took him 40 days on the mountain was copying it. And so it's not even Moses' words, it's God's very words. And that's why you can't reduce it to Greek or to anything else. This is the language of God. Well, obviously lots of people believe their language is God's language. And I'm sure that some of you grew up thinking God's said to the, well, I learned God said in the garden, Adam Vodistu. Never mind. What is it in Scripture? Anyway, so this is a part of the tradition in which the father-in-law is Jethro and the holy mountain is Horeb, and God identifies God's self with this word we sometimes pronounce in Hebrew, Yahweh, God's personal name, translated into English as the Lord, for reasons that we're not going to go into. So there's a bit of a mystery.
But the rest of what I really want us to see this morning in the 25 minutes that we have left, I'd like us to see by leaving Exodus for a moment and looking at a few other stories of people in such encounters as this. And I know some of you have done this many times. It's a kind of classic of study of the Hebrew Bible to look at the so-called call narratives to notice the pattern that's in them. So would you turn, please, for a moment to Isaiah chapter 6, and we'll look at another one of these. We want to read the first, I guess the whole 13 verses of Isaiah 6 is appropriate to read here. Could we read this the same way, just start somewhere about where we left off with Exodus and go around and read a verse or two and get this allowed out into the space here?
In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with 6 wings. With 2 wings they covered their faces, with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory."
The pivots on the thresholds shook at the voices of those who called, and the house filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me! I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, holding a live coal that had been taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. The seraph touched my mouth with it and said, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed, and your sin is blotted out."
Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send me." And he said, "Go away and go and say to this people, keep listening, but do not comprehend. Keep looking, but do not understand.
Make the mind of this people dull, and stop their ears, and shut their eyes, so that they may not look with their eyes, and listen with their ears, and comprehend with their minds, and turn and be healed."
Then I said, "How long, O Lord?" And he said, "Until cities lie waste without inhabitant, and houses without people, and the land is utterly desolate. Until the Lord sends everyone far away, and vast is the emptiness in the midst of the land.
Even if a tenth part remain in it, it will be burned again, like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remains standing when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump."
Okay. Now this text too could take us a day or a week or however long we wanted to spend on it. What sorts of things do you notice that are similar or quite the opposite or different when comparing this to Exodus 3 or with Exodus 3 in mind?
The complete opposite would be the setting.
All right, instead of the place farthest beyond where it's, we're in the Jerusalem temple, or right. So it seems. So instead of the most out of the way, we are in the... Well, they actually called it at one point in their history the navel of the universe. The very center of reality, Jerusalem, Mount Zion, the temple.
In both of them, God takes the initiative to issue the call. We live in a time when we think of ourselves as taking the initiative to seek God's call, And with Moses and Isaiah fairly passive, there's no indication that they're the ones who are searching, but God is the one who is searching and calling.
Yeah, exactly. And God sort of surprises, confronts, hijacks.
But it seems like God is calling, but then he's saying, but don't come near. You know, I mean, to a certain point, I want you to come. And it makes me think of conversations I've had with people where they definitely know, they feel God's presence, but at times they feel shut off to him. And it's such a grief for them.
So an approach avoidance kind of thing. Partly due in both these stories, there's a bit of awesome quality to what the two characters experience.
The difference also in the first story, God being very openly compassionate, let's relieve the misery of these slaves. The second one, more of the heart being closed off, make them stubborn so that they'll be devastated.
Right. Yeah, it's a call to an opposite task in a way. I mean, ultimately, the prophetic tradition would decide that what Isaiah was asked to do is a part of God's saving activity, but it sure didn't look like it at the moment. Yeah, can you imagine being called to do this job that Isaiah is called to? I want you to preach a message that people will refuse. Make them further and further and further stubborn and resistive until they don't hear anything, they don't see anything, they don't understand anything. And Isaiah understandably says, well, how long do I have to do that? God says, oh, just till everything's wasted. You know, when everything's gone, then you can quit. Oh, thanks.
In the first story, God tells Moses what he wants him to do, and Moses says, well, who am I to do that? And in the second story, Isaiah says, I'll do it. What is it? And then God tells him.
Yeah.
But even Isaiah says, I can't do it.
Right. Both
have trouble speaking. Yeah. Moses says he can't speak well, and Isaiah says I'm a man of unclean lips and I can't speak well.
Both of them eventually say, in effect, who, me? I think you got the wrong person here. But it is true there's a slightly different order. And there's one of the things that you'll notice in most such stories like this is there's a specific little phrase that in this one appears right away. In the first one appears right away, and in this one appears later, as the gentleman has said. It's in Isaiah, it's Exodus. In Isaiah, it's chapter 6, verse 8. Mm-hmm. Only after the hot coals have touched Isaiah's lips does he say, here am I, send me. Moses right away says, here I am. And the little expression, here I am, the putting oneself at the calling one's disposal is a crucial piece of these stories and the pattern of these stories, as we'll see. It's a little tiny Hebrew word, hineni, and it's almost always translated, here I am. It's what Abram says when God speaks to him at the beginning of Genesis 22, when God will want Abram to take his son whom he loves, up the mountain. God will show him and make a sacrifice of him there. God says, Abram. And Abram says, Hineni. Here I am. I'm at your disposal. But then on the way up the mountain, Isaac begins to notice something amiss and says, Father. And Abram says, Hineni. Yes, what is it? I'm here to answer. So this is the way you put yourself, or you come to attention, as it were. But it happens after the taking care of the difficulty in Isaiah, but before in Exodus, and that's significant. Anything else you see that's alike or different? Well, we've already had another one, excuse me, that we didn't comment on. That is the objection that each of the parties has to this, the who me. Now, you said Moses said he couldn't speak. That's actually later. That didn't appear. He will eventually describe himself as a man of uncircumcised lips. That is, a man of uncultured and untrained lips. But all he says is, you know, who am I? I'm not your guy. In Exodus, Isaiah says, I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live in a people of unclean lips. What does that mean? I don't think it's a potty mouth. That's not what unclean is about. Unclean is the opposite of holy in the Hebrew Bible. Unclean at this point probably means about the same thing that vulgar originally meant, common, ordinary. So all Isaiah is saying, at least on the surface, is, you know, here I am in the presence of holiness, you know, the utter uniqueness of God, and I'm just an ordinary guy with an ordinary mouth and ordinary words. Although it could mean something more base and more profane than simply ordinary. You got feet in both, uncovered feet in both. Although, as most of you know, this is an expression or something else in this text. You know what a serif is? You probably picture medieval artwork with angels, you know, humanoid, winged creatures, different from cherubim, who are usually pictured as fat little Anglo-Saxon babies with wings flying around nativity scenes. Literally, what seraph means is on fire. Whatever a seraph is, it's on fire. And it has wings with which it covers parts of itself. And this expression for covering your feet is generally thought, I'm sure most of you have heard, to refer to the private parts. So, flaming critters with private parts that need to be covered up, who go around singing, Kadosh, 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 holy, holy, holy. So we got fire in both stories, and a holiness phenomenon.
Last week, Larry Rasmussen brought along a picture of a mural in or a mosaic in Ravenna. And it had, I don't know if it was here then, but it was the scene in which God calls Moses. And the burning bush was not a bush, but it was like tongues of, I guess that's what I said. There were little flames all over.
Uh-huh.
And we were wondering what those flames could be. Why were they pictured in that way? And I suggested perhaps it was looking back through Pentecost imagery to this story. Mm-hmm. But now I begin to wonder if there was some seraph stuff going on there too, or if it was sans serif.
Well, I mean, in a way, they're all connected, aren't they? I mean, by the biblical stories play with each other so commonly, and they're all stories of association with fire and the receiving of words. You know, that's what happens at Pentecost. It's fire that doesn't actually burn up your hair, and you get words. And artists know how to do this, so you can connect them all more easily than in other ways. Well, there's another one that I want to look at. There's two more, actually, that I want to look at quickly and try to draw some implications. There's another one of these accounts in Jeremiah that's in some ways quite different, but has similar features. Jeremiah 1, verses 4 and following. After the superscription of this collection of Jeremiah that sets it in time, we get the call of Jeremiah. Can we read that one too, please? Just 4 to 10. I don't know where we left off.
Now the word of the Lord came to me, saying, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations."
And I said, "Ah, Lord God, truly I do not know how to speak, for I am only a boy." But the Lord said to me, "Do not say, 'I am only a boy,' for you shall go to all whom I send you, and you shall speak whatever I command you.
Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you, declares the Lord." Then the Lord stretched out his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said to me, "Behold, I have put my words in your mouth. See, I have appointed you this day over the nations and over the kingdoms, to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant."
Okay. So there Jeremiah gets, Isaiah was commissioned only to say things that brought ruin. Jeremiah gets six things, four of which are that way, and two of which are hopeful. So, and as we know, at the end of Jeremiah, we will finally run into some hopeful things, even though it still didn't help him with his job satisfaction quotient. He still was a miserable fellow who hated his life. Similarities you notice there? Differences?
Excuses.
Pardon me?
Excuses.
All right, once again, it's got the who, me. That's typical of all of them. So in every one of them, you have, in one way or another, God calls, and the prophet or the party called says, "Who, me?" You must have the wrong person. In Jeremiah's case, he pleads you.
Yeah, I've noticed this pattern in call narratives. There are more where the person being called says, "I've got the wrong person." And you know, we kind of have probably experienced that in our own lives as well. What I haven't noticed until today is how each time it's about not having the words.
You know, and so often when we are trying to be in ministry, whether just to the friend next to us or in a public situation, that's what feels lacking, is the words.
What am I going to say?
Yeah.
Or not go, you know, what am I going to say? And so that's what I'm hearing you hear. It kind of keeps up with your theme of beyond words, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's a little more than just simply not having the words, but not having the authority on my own, that, you know, to speak a word, you know, or to say something is to say something with some kind of authority, but not having that.
Right. Like, you've got some words, but they're not the words God needs. They don't have the authority. The words I have don't have the authority necessary for this situation, or whatever words are necessary, I can't speak them.
That raises the question for me then, what has silenced that person? Is it being a slave? Is it pain or grief, or is it just lack of knowledge, language, but what has caused the speechlessness?
Yeah. And we have a variety of such difficulties here. What do you notice about place? We have a holy place in Exodus and Isaiah. Where does the call, where does Jeremiah understand his call to have taken place?
In the womb?
In his mother's womb. There's a thing to ponder for a moment, but another kind of holy place. And it is, I mean, it is a place beyond words. You are unfinished and don't speak yet if you're called there. And, you know, this begins to wax homiletical, not exegetical, but, and I've never been pregnant, and probably ought to be careful talking about it, but I would guess you feel like you're in transition between one life and another when you're pregnant. You are in the wilderness, you are in the place beyond words. Especially the first time, you're not quite, and you're no longer not a mother, but you're not exactly a mother yet either. So this is a...
You're in a place of great uncertainty.
Yeah.
In many ways.
A unique place. You're in a unique place, which is...
It also seems to, it's before, in the NRSV, it's before I formed you in the womb as well. So in the way you were talking before about the beyond the wilderness or the deep of the wilderness. So again, it's kind of moving beyond that place that you see as...
I work with women and men who have experienced miscarriage or loss of stillbirth, and they talk about the loss of a dream, and they know that there's a word for that they are parents, yet the world doesn't see them as parents necessarily yet. So I think of the void in the moment of the womb, that we know it to be holy, yet the world doesn't have a word for us when we...
Well, in a sense, too, you're being called when you're pregnant, whether you're the mother or the father. It's a calling, and you have so many different feelings, but you don't feel prepared. You don't feel like you're qualified
Which is the perfect segue to the last call narrative we have time for this morning. We're going to pretend that there's 1 minute left. And flip to Luke chapter 1. Luke says he got his stuff for his gospel from all over the place. So we don't know exactly who put together this little operetta that he begins with. This 16 operetta with all the musical numbers. But somebody put together the story of Mary getting pregnant as a call narrative. Look at verse 26 and following. In the sixth month, that's of Elizabeth's pregnancy, the angel Gabriel was sent by God to a town in Galilee called Nazareth to a virgin engaged to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. Her name was Mary. He came to her and said, "Greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you." She was very perplexed at this, wondered what kind of greeting this is. The angel says, "Do not be afraid. You found favor with God. You will conceive in your womb and bear a son and name him Jesus. He'll be great," and so on. Mary says, "Who, me? Haven't you noticed I have no husband? I am a virgin." So there we got the standard parts. Call, demur. And now we're going to overcome the objection by saying, not to worry, the Holy Spirit will take care of this. Besides, we've already done part one. Elizabeth, your barren kinswoman, is already 6 months along. We can do this. With God, nothing is impossible. And look what Mary says.
Here I am.
Here I am. Exactly what you're supposed to say in the sermon. So she is, pregnancy is a call. And her pregnancy in particular is a call. And what all those other prophets were going to bear for the world is, or for God's people, is the word of God. And of course in Christian theology, as apparently the person who fashioned this narrative in or for Luke knows, Mary would bear the word, what Christians came to call the word incarnate. So whoever put this together in Luke knew those old call narratives very well and uses it to explain some important things about the meaning of this. We're out of time. I had some more things I was going to do, but we have all week. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.